Well, keep in mind that you're on the ninth. Fox.
I got it.
Might be a plus.
I think it's a plus.
So there's our action. We did the complex scalar. Still spin zero, but you have two of them coupled. Now you don't need the half. These pieces are independent. So we take that action. We've done the spinner case, where the action is the drag action. So now we're ready to move to vector fields. This is spin 1/2. Vector fields. Okay. So what action do we want to write?
How do you write higher spin actions? Is there a way to do that systematically? Or?
That's what I just asked you.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. But, okay, keep it simple. What do you want in here? So we've got some vector field. Let's call it some vector radius. Okay. What do you need to have in an action in order to get the sensible field equation?
Tensor smash.
Okay. Well, it's a vector, it's a tensor.
Okay.
Alright, so think of your basic action. It's a functional of some fields and derivatives of the field.
Right.
And, you know, higher derivatives of the field and coordinates, but we never do that. Right? We build it out of the fields and derivatives of the field, so our list is going to stop there. Okay, now, what's the action? In a way, it's a trick question, and in a way, it's not. What's the simplest thing you can write?
Just A mu times A mu.
Or A mu down, A mu up. Yeah.
A mu what?
A mu down, A mu up. Yeah.
Okay.
Or something.
There's that. That's simple. Does it give us anything? Okay, vary it. You know, del S equals 0, and that's equal to twice A mu del A mu, and we get A mu equals 0. Yeah.
It's a gauge choice, right? Yeah.
What's that?
It's the gauge choice, right?
What gauge? You said anything about
okay,
gauge.
Okay.
That's the trick. That's what's tricky about the question. I'm not asking about a gauge theory. I'm not asking about electromagnetism. I'm asking about a general vector field. What you put in an action are derivatives of the field, right? I mean, you need the kinetic energy, right? And then you can add potential energy. So let's add some kinetic and potential type terms. What would a kinetic energy look like here?
Are we doing it like the scalar field thing? D mu A, D mu A, D mu A down, D mu A.
Oh, there's an idea.
Okay.
What do I do next? So yeah, D mu, tell me what to write.
A V down, I don't know.
A nu.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. I like it. That looks like a kinetic energy because mu runs over time, so I've got A dot squared kinetic energy. Great. And then there are some potential terms that come along because it's relativistic, so we've got to gotta have those too. Here, let's add your other one. We want to add it with a constant. You know, we want something in here if I'm going to add. All right, to make a Lorentz scalar, I need to square it like this. What should I call the constant?
Charge.
This, right? Just put an index on 5.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, that'll work. What are we going to get? put a half here, because when I vary it, I'm going to get a factor of 2 everywhere. So I'm going to get d mu del a mu d mu a mu plus m squared a mu del. And let me do this from the other way, though. Which one do I want to go out? That one. Okay, and then I integrate by parts and throw out the surface term. So I'm going to get minus, right, I'm going to throw this derivative over onto there. So I'll have minus box a nu minus m squared a nu del a nu plus the surface term. And we conclude box A minus M squared. Zero. Weingarten type equation. Great. That's what everything else satisfies too. No reason that a vector field should. Alright. So why is this so unfamiliar? Because we're used to a gauge theory. Alright. We're used to a theory where A has some unphysical freedom to it. All right, so when we write Maxwell's equations, we know that the, have we got enough of the relativistic version of Maxwell's equations that we can just write it down? Or do we need to derive the relativistic form again? To the front row, write it to the back row.
DF equals zero. Star D.
Star D equals
zero.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, let's do it that. I like that way. Okay, so a vector field we can write as a one form, A. That's nice. And then we can take DA and call that thing F. And then that gives us DF equals zero. Those are the homogeneous Maxwell equations. And then we can take the divergence of F, and that's star D star DA. That's got to be something. Well, let's call the something a J. And now we don't have to make that. Let's just call the something a J. Those are the other Maxwell equations. So they're all Maxwell's equations. And notice that we take star D star of star D star of F. That's equal to star D. Star of star is 1, so we just get D squared star of F. And D squared of anything is 0. And all of that means that star D star J is 0. That's the four-dimensional divergence of the current. That's the continuity equation. So we've got pretty much anything we need to do to do electromagnetism. There. That was easier than getting it from the freshman version. All right. So what's different about this vector field? Different from this vector. I'll be able to spot two differences. Yeah, let's call this one A tilde maybe so we can talk about it. So I'm not using the same symbol for two different things. There we go. Okay, so what's the difference between A and A tilde?
One's a potential.
A tilde has a divergence in it or something.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Good. That's true, because I wasn't thinking about that. Okay. A mu is a potential. Okay, what's the difference between a potential and just field? Right, you know, potential is not something we measure directly, right? We calculate a field from it. So, it can have unphysical parts. So, what's unphysical about this A?
You can change it by like a divergence and still get the same field equations, I believe. Right.
You're on the right track.
Sort of, yeah.
It's equivalent.
D squared is 0, so, right.
D A plus D squared phi is identically 0, so okay, so the field is unchanged if I change A by a gradient.
Right.
How are you doing with the differential forms here?
Good.
Joe?
Ask me fine.
You've forgotten all about it, right? We did a bit with them last winter, right?
They did the homework.
What's that?
Nathan did the homework for that.
Didn't do the homework.
You did the homework for the instant thing. You did the homework then.
For what? Sorry.
Differential forms.
For differential.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Right.
Okay.
yeah, sorry. It's been a while.
Okay, can I give you clues or hints that will help, Joe?
I'm largely seeing it. I don't think I could produce it. But
I'm not using it in a heavy way here.
Right.
If you remember, d squared is 0.
Sure.
Because that comes from the symmetry of mixed partials. And when you take each d has a dx, so there's a wedge product there, so you're anti-symmetrizing the mixed partials. So d squared is 0 acting on anything. That's the only thing I've really used from that's the Poincaré lemma. Okay, so what do we do if we want to build a field theory for this thing? I was asking another question. Differences between A and A tilde. So A is a potential, which means it doesn't have to be all physical, and we further observe that it actually can be changed by an entire gradient of a free function and still get the same physical result. So we have to work with F. All right, well, what that means is we'd better build the action out of F instead of building it out of A directly. Well, F is built out of the derivatives of A, so that's no big trick, right? We do the same thing. So for the action, right, we had d mu a tilde nu d mu a tilde nu. Now we have f mu nu is d mu a nu minus d mu a mu. That curl gets rid of the gradient. not d mu a nu squared, but I'm going to have these other things. So what I want to write is d mu a nu minus d mu a nu. This is still going to give me an a dot squared somewhere. Then d mu a nu minus d mu a nu. And I can call that f mu nu, f mu nu. But what is it? It's just our kinetic term modified to get rid of the gauge dependence. So we can try something like this for the action instead of d mu a nu tilde squared. What's the other difference between these two fields? Or another difference. There may be some I'm not picking up again, but I see another one. Often a mu is called the photon. That's the band.
Has a mass.
Bingo. A tilde has a mass, right? A had better not, because photons don't have that kind of cloud. Massive.
But for a general vector field, can we have something with a mass? I mean,
we just wrote one.
We just wrote one, right.
Got it, yeah. Feinberg, no problem, yeah.
Okay.
We can even write a theory like this that has a mass. That's called the Proca Lagrangian.
The what?
Proca.
Proca.
Oh, I'll put it down.
Okay. Is that an exhaust thing?
So, we could write a massive action. As Proca is usually we put a quarter here because that makes things come out nicely when you write the equation, but it's all this junk squared. And let's add m squared a mu a mu. But for E and M, m squared a mu prime, a mu prime is going to be m squared a mu plus d mu prime squared. And that m squared a squared, sure, but there's all this other junk too. Too bad for that. What that means is the action depends explicitly on the gauge, which is the unphysical part. So you don't want that. You vary the gauge, you get some fuel equation for phi, right? Phi is not physical. So this is no good at all. So we cannot have a term like this to give a mass to the photon. There's no way in a U1 gauge theory, which seems developed as a U1 gauge theory, that we can add that mass term and still have our gauge invariance. So that term is not there for E and M. Yeah.
Electrons don't emerge from E and M field theory. Where do the electrons?
Right. Electrons, you don't have any sources for E and M until you have some charged particles around.
And those don't necessarily come from the field theory for E and M, they come from somewhere else?
Spinners.
Okay.
Spinners have charge.
Okay. And mass.
And mass. Yeah. Complex scale. Right. Both of those, both of these have a conserved U1 current.
Uh-huh.
Right? There's a phase invariance in each of these actions. If we gauge that phase invariance, or just apply another theorem, we get a conserved current. That's J mu for Maxwell's equations. The currents we get from that phase invariance, those are exactly the sources for the Maxwell equations. Yeah. We'll put this all together. Have you got the pictures?
That works.
So this is okay. I'll leave our list up there. So we have massive
vector field. For which we write S is a half. These don't seem to occur in nature, but we can write them down, so if we suddenly tomorrow found one in nature, we'd know what to do with it. Then we have a PROCA. A PROCA field is just like electromagnetism, except we go ahead and add the mass term. Maxwell action, not that Maxwell ever wrote this. That's all we can
do. He would have wrote it all up in components at the end.
Yeah, he would have, yeah. It was the first half of the 20th century when scientists argued strongly for the use of action, of the action of a action functional, the world function or something like that. Is, I think Bile used to call it that. But
action of an action?
Yeah. The what?
Is it action of an action?
No. The world function. I was repeating myself. An action functional. The use of action functionals as the generating object of field theory really probably has there are two strong arguments for it. One is Miller's theorem. The other is quantization. Feynman path integral. You can put the action in a path integral if you know how to quantize it. If it doesn't come from an action, you don't know how to quantize it. So those two principles have huge physical consequences and really argue strongly for having an action for whatever theory you want to write down. There are field equations that don't come from any action, but they're probably not the right ones. I'm not sure how I write one down.
Example of that?
What's that?
Any examples of that?
Nothing on the top of my head. Yeah, there's a way to test. Basically, you take like the you need sort of a curl of the field equation. So if the field equation is going to hold, then some generalized curl of that has to vanish in order for it to be the variation of an integral. It's probably a functional derivative, anti-symmetrized that has to vanish. There's some condition like that. I don't know any examples. If we had the theorem in hand, we could probably cook one up. Yeah. certainly nothing that, is what we're going to be looking at.
Is something comes, if I can write down the Hamiltonian of something, can I write down a Lagrangian for it? I mean,
you can go either way as long as the equation relating the momentum or momentum fields and the velocity fields is invertible.
Okay.
Right? If you can go back and forth between momentum and velocity, you're cool.
Okay.
Okay. Maxwell theory. So we should explore it. Let's bury it. What happens? We have quarter. We're going to get two factors that are variation of F mu nu and F mu nu. If we go inside that variation is d mu del A nu minus d nu del A. because this F is anti-symmetric, those two terms are the same. In the second term, I can just rename mu as nu and nu as mu, flip this and get a sign canceling that sign, and it looks just like the first term. So the other half goes away, and I can write this as d mu del a nu, f mu nu. And now I get a surface term minus integral del a nu of d mu f mu nu. So I conclude that the divergence of f mu nu is zero. So there's my vacuum Maxwell equation. Here, let me go through the claim I made before. Let's look at, you had all this right now. Let's look at all our conserved U1 currents. We haven't made the theory locally U1 invariant. Alright, this has global U1. Alright, U1 is just multiplication by a phase. So if I replace phi by e to the I b phi, Juan will be appalled because he actually speaks Latin. But
well, this is Greek, though.
That's true. It's okay. But Greek. If you get into Latin, do you study history too? Do you like the history of Rome?
I learned a little bit of
Latin.
I'm studying Latin.
I really like ancient history. So we can let phi go to e to the I, phi naught, phi. The Maxwell potential is real, so nothing happens there. But that leaves S invariant. If we want to make it local, what we do is everywhere we have a d mu, we have to replace it by a covariant derivative given by the partial mu minus I a mu, where a mu is a gauge field. It happens to be the same a mu in there. I mean, we've done this the other way around where we've introduced the invariant, but I just want to write in an invariant action and calculate the currents. So let's go ahead and quickly do this. So then d mu of phi is going to go to d tilde mu of e to the I b phi, it's going to be e to the I phi d mu phi. Same for psi, e tilde e to the I b psi is going to be e to the I b mu phi. And that's the condition we need, so just replacing all of these derivatives by capital D, that's exactly the condition we need in order for S to be locally U1 invariant. So the
local U1 form of S, let's go ahead and be explicit here, local U1 is going to be dmu of phi r dmu of phi of m squared phi star phi plus phi dagger I capital B slash minus m phi plus 1/4 Maxwell squared. Okay, so cool.
You have a question?
Mm-hmm.
You said once that we can get Maxwell's equations by gauging this just the scalar field, right? Yeah.
Yeah, either one.
So is it, would it be like redundant then having both the scalar and also the spinner thing, the action in there?
Redundant.
We get the same equations twice or something, or?
There might be scalar fields, there might be spinner fields in nature. There are actually, we know, are quite a few spinner fields in nature. If you'd like to write a theory of, say, pions satisfy a Klein coordinate equation. I mean, you build them out of quarks, of course, so you don't really write a theory of pions per se, but you could. There aren't actually many scalar fields in nature. So you're recognizing that if we had either of these and just
right.
This the local gauge theory, we would end up adding this term and adding that covariant derivative. So you're right, you know, we only need one or the other in order to motivate the U1 gauge theory.
Right.
But a realistic particle physics action may have dozens and dozens of terms. I've seen, you know, actions that fill whole slides.
No.
They get very long sometimes. If you really write out the action for the standard model, you know, you've got SU2 and U1 symmetries. You know, you've got to describe, you know, six different quarks and, you know, six different leptons and, maybe the graviton, you know, all the W's and Z's and, you know, field strength. And then if you supersymmetrize it, it's four times as long. So, you know, it gets to be big, hairy thing. So, you know, a realistic action is going to have a bunch of terms. You know, we might have some over, well, if we want all six quarks, you know, over six of these, right, where actually the masses are different. But at high energy, we don't care because the masses are small compared to the energy involved. But
along the same lines, when we write an action research-wise,
mm-hmm.
Since we have Lie algebra value one forms, we don't have to write a term for each particle, right? I don't have to write a term for D,
yeah.
W plus, and W minus because I have.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, the six
index.
Quarks, you know, some work earlier on before the standard model really gelled, people would write an SU6 invariant theory where you had an index that ran from 1 to 6 over all the six quarks. Well, that symmetry is broken because they have different masses. You could, you know, if you just had six of these all with the same mass, then you could do a unitary transformation on this one. You'd get the conjugate unitary transformation over here, and it'd just go away. But the mass is being different makes it not an exact symmetry. That symmetry is called Flavor. Flavor symmetry, or it takes you between generations. Yeah, so you get very concise about a lot of things. That's right. Now, let's see. Let's look next space. We've got our whole list here.
I think so.
Question.
What's the difference between a mass and vector field and a Broca field?
This has the curl of A. It,
there, you just have some extra terms in here. It's sort of, Proca is midway between these two. Remember that F is d mu A, d nu A, d mu A nu minus d nu A mu. So, I'll have to erase it now, but this is a sum of four terms,
okay.
Right, where you interchange the mu's and nu's.
Okay.
All right, now, in terms of the resulting physics, well, this A won't satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. You'll have another term there. In fact, what you'll have, well, let's just vary it and see. That's a good question. We didn't vary it. So, the field equation for the Proca Lagrangian. It's going to look the same here, but then we get the mass term. So we're going to have the variation will be just like what I did for E and M. So you get a factor of 4, and then you'll have B mu del A nu with F mu nu. And then you'll get the mass term. This. You integrate by parts, and so you'll end up with d mu f mu nu minus m squared a nu equals 0. So you get a mass term, but instead of just the D'Alembertian here, this is d mu of d mu a nu minus d mu b nu a nu minus m squared a nu equals 0. So this is the D'Alembertian. So we get box. So we get box minus m. Squared. That would be the Klein-Gordon. But we also get the gradient of the divergence of A as part of the field equation. So there's that additional term. Good practice varying in action fill in this extent. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or when you're adding force terms, do you not necessarily make them out of tensors? Yeah, I'm just curious. Like in an action.
In an action? Yeah, you make everything out of some kind of tensor.
Okay.
Depends on
okay.
what invariant you want the action to have.
Okay.
So if you have some group symmetry that's important to you, say Lorentz symmetry,
mm-hmm.
then everything is a Lorentz tensor. I mean, we spent that whole time at the beginning of the
right.
term saying, oh, what we've got scalars, spinners, vectors, you know, spin n over 2 for any integer. So those are the Lorentz covariant. Those are the Lorentz tensors.
Okay.
Well, if we have a U1 symmetry, everything now is a tensor under U1, including our derivatives. Right? So we have to use capital D mu of phi. That's a vector under U1. Well, everything's a scalar under U1. It just gets a multiple of the phase. But, you know, everything, you know, it gets a positive phase or a negative phase, essentially.
So all scalars are tensors, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, scalars are tensors. But scalars under what? You have to say what your symmetry transformations are. What group do you want the tensors of?
Mm-hmm. It seems like math would be a scalar under everything, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, actually, you know, if you hope, as many of us do, to derive the masses of fundamental particles, you'd like some theory where they're not quite scalars, but where you actually generate some spectrum of possible masses. Theories do that, but they tend to be constant intervals and not very interesting.
Hmm.
I mean, not really predictive. String theory, for example. In string theory, there are massive modes of the string, okay? Modes of oscillation of the string that, you know, have some invariant m squared associated with them. Well, the lowest value of m that's allowed for a string state, you know, this would be some particular particle. it's something like a Planck mass, right? It's huge. So all of the particles that are described by string theory that we ever expect to see are the massless ones. And then you give them mass by a Higgs mechanism or something. So there is a spectrum in like multiples of the Planck length, but who cares? You know, we're not going to see those particles. They're way too massive. So one example of a theory where, yes, you predict the mass spectrum, but it's not the mass spectrum you're really interested in.
Okay. So we can't really predict the spectrum, we just put an N in there.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, there are things that are in between. High energy phenomenology, where people, you know, are really working closely with particle accelerators and the standard model. There's a thing called the Kobayashi-Muskawa matrix, which is a matrix of masses for various particles. But you actually start computing the corrections to the mass that's given by the energy of bound states. So you can actually, you know, predict some of the relationships in that matrix. Or here's another example: the mass of the proton. You come very close to predicting the mass of a proton by doing a quantum chromodynamic calculation with three quarks in it. Now, the three quarks are massive. You've got two up and one down quark in a proton. Okay, so you add together the masses of those plus the energy contribution E equal mc squared gamma contribution, because those quarks are moving around furiously and producing gluons that also have a whole bunch of energy. And it turns out that, I forget how much, something like 95% of the mass of a proton is energy. So you can account for almost all of the energy of a mass of a proton just from the energy of the particles that make it up. It'd be nice if you could get it all. You know, maybe there's some way to do that. But so far, in the standard model, there are masses for the quarks and the leptons. I mean, the electron has an electron mass, no getting around that. And there's no evidence for it to be composite. Right? The thing you quantize is, you know, like the Coulomb field, an exact Coulomb field. So it looks like a point particle when you do QED. I mean, the action you start with, of course, you know, you get all these quantum corrections that, you know, make it a very fuzzy ball, but you're still sticking the Maxwell action into a path integral to compute what happens. We like something that predicts the mass of the lepton and the quarks. That would be really nice. The tau and the muon electron, you know, different masses. Why? You know, what's the difference between these things? And why are there those three with those ratios of masses? Open question. It's been an open question for, you know, 75 years or something. I don't know. So, yeah, you'd like something that gives you.
Whose mass matrix was that?
don't ask me to spell it. Let's see. Kobayashi. That's not so hard. Kobayashi. And Muskawa. A-S. I'm not sure of the spelling.
Who's it, you?
Muskawa? Yeah, it seems like. I'm not sure what letter goes here. Put the vowel of your choice second.
Google will figure it out.
Was there anything predictive about it, or no?
You know, I think there is, because, you know, people have continued to work on this matrix in the literature and, you know, tune it and, you know, put in electromagnetic corrections to masses and things. So I think it's a combination of theory and phenomenology that leads to the present form of it. And there may be generalizations of that object. I mean, this has been around for 50 years, and I'm not sure where it has gone in that time. specifying the masses of the particles that come into the standard model is you know, there's a lot that goes into it. And people do a lot of work in QED predicting masses of mesons, you know, predict the mass of the pion from the fact that it's a combination of two quarks, quark and quark. So you can actually say something about that. The calculations are long, but let's see, where are we? What I want to do is I want to look at these two actions. I'm going to erase what's between them. And I want to see first what Nukes says about this. So let's look at the... conserve another current. How do we get them? Right. We want to vary this, and then we're going to restrict the variation to be the symmetry variation. The term that comes up as the current is the surface term. So if I vary phi, I'm going to get, say I vary phi star, I'm going to get d mu of del phi, and then I'm going to end up with a surface term that looks like this. So this is what I identify as the current. So we have a J mu that looks like that. Let's do it this way. We're also going to have one when we vary phi, so we'll have phi star d mu del phi, except now we have integrated that one by part. So the d mu is over here. Here, we're going to vary psi and phi bar. So we'll have a term that depends on the variation of psi bar. There will be an I and phi. And then with the other sign, we'll have something that's psi bar with the variation of psi. So these are the another current. There would be that was a d slice, so there's a gamma mu in those terms. Everything should have a d mu somewhere. There we go. So the current should look like that. Did I give you enough detail to understand what we did there? Then del phi is, all right, that's e to the I phi phi minus phi. For an infinitesimal phi, it's just I phi times the field, phi. Fun to say. For the conjugate, del of phi star is going to be minus I phi times phi star. The variation of psi is I phi times psi, and the variation of psi bar is going to be minus I phi times phi bar. So J mu, now this phi is going to be some constant. All right, I'm looking at the global symmetry here. So this is a phi naught here. So there's a common factor phi naught in all of these terms. I'm just going to pull it out. And for J mu, I'm going to have, I'll have minus I phi naught here. So there's a minus I, minus I phi star d mu phi. Then here we have plus I phi
phi d mu phi star. Here we have, it's going to be minus I phi r gamma mu psi, and here, minus I here gives plus 1, so it looks like it's a factor of 2 on that. Like that. I'm not sure why that is, but those are the currents. I'm suspicious of that factor of 2. Let's see, did I do something? There probably should have been a half. Okay, if I were to write this as a half psi I d slash minus m psi minus phi bar I d the other way plus m psi. Alright, then if I vary this, alright, this has a d mu of phi, so this only contributes to the surface term when I vary phi. So from this I'll get this I, I'll have a gamma mu and the variation of psi. From this term, right, the derivative is on this, so I only get a surface term from that one, and that will contribute I phi bar gamma mu by del psi bar. Then when I put in I phi naught here and minus I phi naught there, they're going to add. But then I have this factor of a half. So I get a half times minus 2i phi bar gamma psi, and the half goes away. So
20 both terms in there from that.
So I get a factor of 2 from the two terms, but I have a half because I've written it explicitly in real form. Only the terms that I have a derivative of give a surface term. Did I answer your question?
So should we have a half in the original action somewhere, or no? Or
no,
just take the real part of this.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Everybody with me now? So, this is the conserved nether current.
And the conserved charge is making mu equal 0, is that right? And then taking integral over space, over all space.
Yes,
okay,
that's right.
Okay.
And that will be the electric charge. But let's give some convincing evidence for that. What I want to do is vary the local action now with respect to the vector potential. And guess what's going to show up as the source for the Maxwell field? That is current. Watch.
Where did C, not phi, but C not go in that?
It's just a constant. I canceled it.
Okay.
It's just a normalization of J.
Okay.
In my definition of J, I can put a constant multiplying the whole thing to normalize it. The constant is probably E, right? Or the fine structure constant.
So with the I in here, is this real?
Let's see, yeah. This is a difference between complex conjugates, so this becomes real.
Okay.
And
then for that last term.
There's probably a half there, too.
No, there's not a half. Okay. So, yeah, that is real. And the last one looks kind of real, too. No, imaginary. Well, hard to tell.
Okay. I'm curious. I was, right.
Yeah, if I take the dagger, then let's see. I wonder about that one. That one looks like it. Okay, it depends on the conventions you're getting.
Pretty gamish. Okay.
Let's not dig into it to prove whether it's real or not. We choose our convention. The presence of this eye, you know, is going to make that real. But the presence of that eye depends on your gamma matrix conventions too, on your metric convention.
Okay.
It takes a while. You know, if you want to really make predictions in this theory, you need to be careful about your conventions. But this is consistent with Maggiore anyway. Okay, so very A. And you in as well. So, 0 equals del A of S. Now, remember, this action, I'm gonna vary everything, right? I can vary phi, and I get a Klein-Gordon equation for phi. I vary psi, I get a Dirac equation for psi. I vary A mu, that's the equation we're finding. So there are other variations we can do to find the other field equations. But for this one, there are now A mu's all over the place because these covariant derivatives are D mu plus I A mu phi, right? For example. So I'm going to get a number of things here. Okay, first term, there's going to be del I del A mu phi star covariant derivative phi. Then I'm also going to have I del then phi star phi nothing, then Dirac, I get psi bar, there's an I on A, so I just get gamma mu del A mu phi. Now, the I is going away here, but, and then F mu nu, we know that we end up with D mu del A mu F mu nu. So, let's see, integrating this one by parts, bringing that to the other side of the equation, what we get is D mu F mu nu is equal to all of this stuff without the del A nu. Now, lower this index to a nu, raise that index to it. So raise and lower indices and make it a nu to match the pre-index here. And I have I, phi star. The only difference now is that the derivative has become covariant with respect to U1. And we've got a sign funny. Where did the funny sign go? This probably needs to be, since we've got an I in this, we need a conjugate there. So this one's going to have a minus sign. And what we get is the covariant version of the another current. Let's see, just right. Yeah, except the I here went away because the covariant derivative has an IA in it that cancels that I. It makes me wonder here if it could have avoided the I. It's just a constant. We're allowed to multiply this by a constant, and it's still a conserved current. So, as I say, we do whatever's appropriate there. But now, the source for Maxwell's equations comes from fundamental fields. So we don't just say, oh, we've got all these charges. We take the continuum limit of the charge density and call it rho and j, right? The field theory tells us what the currents are. And it's exactly those conserved things back from the U1, the original global U1 symmetry already tells us what the conserved currents are going to look like. So we gauge it, the derivatives have to become covariant, but then those provide the source for the Maxwell equation.
So we don't get anything in the global case from that last term, that f mu nu, f up, f mu nu down?
That's the d mu. This is the field equation for A.
Right.
So that's box A on the left.
But in this bottom part though, we don't get anything from the global U1 symmetry from that last term.
F mu nu is gauge invariant and real.
Right.
So it does not transform. Right. When you change A by a gradient and change all the complex fields by a phase, F mu nu is.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's U1 invariant.
Okay.
So it's a scalar under U1.
Okay.
Which is the tension. We can use it. Okay. We should do some other stuff with F. Let's see. Field equation. It really is Maxwell, and we've been through that. Gauge choice. Let's look at the gauge choice in detail. Did you come upon this? You were trying to get this gauge for Maxwell. Did you get it?
Yeah.
It's on page, whatever page that is, 67. Okay. Let's go back to just the Maxwell action, and what we end up doing is somehow, when you have a gauge theory and want to quantize it, it gets tricky because you need to introduce conjugate momenta for your physical field. But only your physical fields. You need to impose commutation relations on the physical degrees of freedom. A mu is your field, it's got some conjugate momentum, except that the gauge freedom means that not all of those degrees of freedom are physical. So you don't want to introduce extra conjugate momenta. You can if you rig a way to get rid of them later. And you don't want your quantization to be quantizing things that aren't real, that don't give you physical content. There are two solutions to that. One is to choose a gauge. So you make gauge choices until you've used up all your gauge freedom, and then you've fixed just the physical part of the field. The drawback of that is that by the time you do that, you've lost Lorentz invariance. So you're now working in a particular Lorentz frame. The predictions you make at the end end up being Lorentz invariant. So you can do that. You're allowed to pick a Lorentz frame and say, okay, I'm going to do all the rest of my calculation in this frame, calculate the raw results, and then you realize, oh, well, I know how to look at this answer in a different frame, and it'll be fine. That's one solution. Another is to come up with a covariant quantization procedure, and those exist too, where you keep everything Lorentz invariant through the whole calculation, but you build in projection operators that project out just the physical parts. Let me show you one of the things that goes funky with the Maxwell action. Suppose we wanted to compute the conjugate momentum to A mu. So we've got a field A mu. The conjugate momentum how do you compute it? You take the partial of the Lagrange density with respect to the time derivative of the field. I mean, already you're picking a Lorentz frame, but that's okay. This is going to be your pi. Okay, so what do we have here? The Lagrange density is a quarter f mu squared, but we better separate this out into. Okay, mu runs 0 and I, so let's let mu equal either 0 or I, where I equals 1, 2, or 3. Separate the time and space, because we have this dot is a time derivative. Okay, so we'll have f, let's see, what, let's write this all in, F0i. When mu takes the value 0, and then we'll have Fji, Ji. Now let's do this one at a time. There, do it this way. Right, so mu takes value 0 or j. Then mu does the same thing, so we'll get 0, 0, f, 0, 0, plus f, 0, I, f, 0, I, plus f, j, 0, f, j, 0, plus f, j, I, f, j, I. There we go. Okay, now, what's f, 0, 0?
Dt a 0
minus
dt a 0. Zero.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. So those are 0. All right. F mu nu is anti-symmetric. So you're just subtracting a thing from it. Okay. These two are the same. I can flip those two. I pick up a minus sign here and a minus sign here. So I just have two of these, and then I have those. So I can write this as a quarter. Now, what is this thing? This is d zero a I minus d I a zero. D zero a I minus d I a zero. Half of that, because I get two of those. And then I have Fij squared. All right. Since I'm taking the derivative with respect to A dot, all I really need to pay attention to are the A dots here, the time derivatives of A. So I have two terms with an A dot. So I'm going to have an Ai dot. And this one is contracted, well, let's see, I have a half AI dot AI dot sum, and then I have two cross terms where I have AI dot DI of A zero. And then I have a di a 0, di a 0, and I have the fij squared. All I need are the a dot terms. That's what's going to give me my momentum. So pi mu, it's going to be, all right, let's do these one at a time. partial of L with respect to A I dot. Okay, we've got 2 here, so we get times 2. We've got 2 of those in the half cancels. So we're just going to end up with A I dot minus partial I A0. All right, and that is just B0 A I minus B I A0. I can raise and lower the zero index because Mangieri uses a plus 1 for that. That's just the electric field. Right. The grad of minus grad phi, and this is minus ddt of the vector potential, the free vector potential. If I raise that to make it a vector, I'd have a minus here too. So you can find it in Jackson. That's the usual formula for the electric field. So the momentum conjugate to the vector potential is the electric field. Cool. What's pi zero? That's partial of L with respect to A zero dot. What do I get?
B field.
What's that?
B field.
Maybe. Try again. Well, there's only one. Partial of L with respect to A0 dot. What is it?
A0?
No. Yeah. There's none in there.
All right, I'm trying to find
one. It doesn't exist. There is no conjugate momentum to A0. This is evidence of the problems you run into because of the gauge invariance of electromagnetism. Right? I can choose a gauge where A0 vanishes, and then this is okay. This is just great. You know, I get rid of A0, then it better not have a conjugate momentum, and it doesn't, so that's good. So, it's a feature, not a bug. It's a thing you've got to work with, and it gets worse with other gauge theories. You need systematic techniques for dealing with gauge theory, doing stuff with the gauge free. Okay, so that's kind of momentum. What else did I want to do with this? Gauge free. Gauge free. Let's see what kind of gauge we can choose.
There are calculations where people do the Fermi conjugate momentum instead of with time, with proper time. Can you do that? Having been a general relativist, it seems like that would be the better thing to do than. I guess if something is massless, doesn't necessarily have.
The thing is, that's not how your Hamiltonian formalism is defined. The proper time would be different for each particle. Whereas your coordinate time, you pick your frame of reference and you've got a coordinate time,
okay,
which in Minkowski space is well defined. Right now, if you're the Rindler wedge undergoing constant acceleration, time is your world line. That is a Killing vector. That's a symmetry for someone who, a constantly accelerating observer, moves in a hyperbola in a light cone. That's constant acceleration. But for that observer, that's the set of those curves form a timeline Killing field. That's the symmetry direction, and you can quantize using that as your notion of time. If you do that, you see a thermal flux of particles in the vacuum. That's Hawking radiation. In a different context. Here, instead of an event horizon, you have an apparent horizon because this observer never sees anything in this part of space-time. That light cone is never exceeded. So there's a whole piece of space-time that they never see that changes their quantum states, and such an observer sees the thermal flux of particles even though they're moving in what to us out here is a vacuum. Very weird stuff. we can change A by a gradient of B. And we can use that to, if we choose the integral of a zero dt, I think is what we need. Right, a zero, the time component is just some function.
Yeah,
that's it. So, up to t prime. So, a zero being a little more explicit here, some function of position and time, integrate that up to time t, let's take it to be minus, then a mu prime is, right, a zero prime is going to be a zero minus ddt of integral a zero d prime. That's zero, because you just get the argument at the upper limit, and that cancels. Ai prime is just something, right? It's ai minus the gradient of that function. Okay, fine, that's some function. It's a different a prime, but we don't care. Now it's just a prime. So, in the new basis, a mu prime is just some, is just zero and the spatial components. So we've gotten rid of one of the spurious degrees of freedom. In fact, the one that doesn't have a conjugate momentum. So that seems like a good thing. Now what? If we make another gauge transformation. Well, what can we do? If we take a mu double prime to be a mu prime plus d mu, let's choose another letter, theta. What has to be true of theta in order for us not to pick up a new piece here? So we've gotten rid of the time component. We want to find our residual gauge freedom. So we can still do another gauge transformation, but we don't want this to change a zero. We still want a zero double prime to be zero.
So you want d zero or del zero of theta to be zero.
Yeah. So we want theta to just be dependent on theta to get fancier here. Theta to be a function of just the coordinates only, no time dependence. Okay. So let's make a choice. What we're after is the Coulomb gauge. That's a gauge where the divergence of A is zero. And let's see if we can't get that to work. The trick is to do it in a way that the problem is you still have some time dependence floating around. You've got to be careful with that. What this means is that the divergence of A prime plus the gradient of this function theta has to be zero. So what we need is del squared of theta equal to minus the divergence of the old A prime. Well, this is just some function. So that's the Poisson equation, and we can solve it. Let's write a solution to that. What we need is theta is equal to minus 1 over 4 pi, the integral of L dot A prime over of, let's say, a function of y minus y d3y, something like that ought to do it. Divergence of A prime, yeah, that's just a thing. Now, if we look at the gradient of theta, and we have minus 1 over 4 pi. Now we have, okay, this depends on y, so this is an x gradient. We can bring it inside the derivative. So this is a function of y. So we have gradient. Del squared, sorry, I want del squared, not gradient. Del squared. With respect to x of 1 over x minus y, dq/dx. Anybody remember their A&M? What's that?
Is that delta function?
4 pi times delta of x minus y.
Okay.
So we have del dot A prime. Then I've already canceled the 4 pi. We get delta of del 3 of x minus y. D3y, and we integrate, and we get, is it plus or minus the delta function?
It is minus.
So we want a plus here, because we want to get a minus to satisfy this. So we just get minus delta. That's the solution to this equation, so that theta will do it. The question is that independent of time? Let's see, if we look at, let's see, theta is dt. Minus 1 over 4 pi. Then we have d0 of L dot A prime over x minus y dq y. So we need to know what d0 of L dot A is. And we're saved by the Maxwell equations. Let's see, where does that show up? A0 is 0, right? We're in the prime system there. So the electric field is equal to the time derivative of A prime I. But then the divergence of the electric field is equal to the time derivative of the divergence of A prime, and that's equal to 0 because we're in vacuum. So if we have sources, that's something, but if we're dealing with the vacuum Maxwell equations, just want to quantize the free field, right? Then this Maxwell equation gives us the constancy of that, and that's just the zeta dt, or that's the integrand here. So that gives us the zeta dt equals. Now you may or may not, if you have sources, you might be able to find some other gauge choice that works. This doesn't prove that, you know, rho is not zero, that you can't do it, but you've got to work harder, certainly. But for the free Maxwell equations, you can find a theta, this theta, such that two gauge conditions hold. A zero vanishes and the divergence bay vanishes. And that brings you down to the 2 degrees of freedom that we know that electromagnetic fields have. Right, this works classically. If you want to describe a free electromagnetic wave, how many polarizations do you need? Yeah. Right. No. If it's going in the z direction, you've got an epsilon in the x and an epsilon in the y. You know. So the general field is oscillating in the plane perpendicular to its motion. So A can, the electric field can point anywhere in that plane. That's 2 degrees of freedom. So those are the two polarizations. You can take them as left circular and right circular, or just X and Y, linear polarization. You get your Polaroid lenses, and you want them, you know, you want them which way? Reflected light off. I forget which way.
Yeah.
You want them to cut
the
reflection. Yeah, reflection at a low angle is polarized. And I forget which way. Let's see. What happens? The tangential part. Yeah, if it all reflects, the tangential part is continuous across the boundary. There's a discontinuity in the normal component of the electric field, so I'm thinking maybe it's horizontally polarized when it comes off the road at you. So if the polarization in your lens only passes the vertical polarization, you'll cut out all those horizontal ones, right? And so it cuts the glaring reflections that you get at low angle off the highway. I could have that backwards for which component is which, but that's the general principle of Polaroid sunglasses. It'll really cut reflection very well. For normal light, it cuts half. Okay, let's see. So, gauge choices. There's another thing that is true here. We have A0 is 0. We have DI. AI is 0. If you combine these, we also have D mu, A mu equals 0. That is a Lorentz invariant condition. That's called the Lorentz gauge. If you just choose that, you can have this without satisfying these. So this is a covariant thing. That's a Lorentz scalar. So you can impose half of the possible gauge constraints without breaking Lorentz invariance. This choice, the Coulomb gauge, breaks Lorentz invariance, and so now you have to work in a particular frame of reference for until you give up the gauge conditioner, or until you derive gauge invariant results, right? So if you do some field theory calculation, that only depends on the field. And so you're going to make predictions about the state of the fields. Well, any such prediction doesn't depend on the gauge. So at the point you've made a claim about the nature of the fields that come out of some scattering experiment, you can say, oh, and this is Lorentz invariant, because it doesn't depend on the gauge. Never mind, we chose a gauge to do the calculation we were allowed to, and the final result is a gauge invariant thing. So, questions on any of this? We should write the stress energy tensor. Energy momentum tensor. Let's see. Yeah. he slowly works his way around to the improved energy momentum tensor. That's the one that we would write down right away, just by varying the metric. So let's do it our way.
Mm-hmm.
That's easier.
Awesome.
Then we can just write it down and go home. It's a little hot, right?
Okay, I don't have the support. I don't know.
What's that?
Okay. So today is a Talk Like a Pirate Day. Yeah.
What's that?
It's not National Talk Like a Pirate Day.
No, that was September 19th.
Oh, really? Really?
It?
Oh.
National Talk Like a Pirate Day. Arr. I need to learn more phrases. I'm from a yardarm. I'll ask you, lovers.
How much does the pirate charge for corn?
Shiver me timbers.
A buccaneer.
Bad rap, guys.
Is John James still around in the program? John James always used to tell elephant jokes. Every day he'd have a different elephant. Okay. The energy momentum. Once again, M quarter, F mu nu, F mu nu, D for X. But how do we do it? How do we find it the easy way? The symmetric way.
Okay.
Yeah. What do we do?
I'm not sure. Let me write it out first. These are the metrics, yeah. So
we've read it up exactly.
Right.
Read it in detail using the metrics. So F comes with the indices down. So that'll do it. And we need our proper volume element here. So now we've written it in a coordinate invariant way. So now, all right, if we vary the metric, we're finding what this field contributes as source to the Einstein equation. Right? Because that's how you get the, you vary the Einstein-Hilbert action, you get the Einstein equation for general relativity. Well, if this is part of your action, you have some Maxwell fields in curved space, you want to vary the metric and get the stress energy tensor, and that's exactly what you get. So let's vary the metric. Well, that's not going to be zero. We don't want it to be zero. We just want to find out the coefficient. Let's see. The quarter is not going to be very important, but we're going to get two terms that look like a variation of G. Now, is it clear that varying each of these gives me the same thing?
G is symmetric.
Yeah, G is symmetric. When I vary this one, it's on nu beta, but I can interchange those for a minus sign and interchange those for another minus sign. Rename all the indices and the two terms come out. So I just get a factor of 2. With this, g, I get a minus a half and the root g back, and then I get a g, let's call it mu alpha del g mu alpha times this original invariant f. Nu beta, F nu beta, like that. And then the whole thing, root G, D, or X. So this term comes from varying that factor. And so we can, let's just define T mu nu to be the coefficient of del G. times 2. So I want to raise, all right, I'm going to have a free mu alpha. Let me raise mu alpha. So I have a mu nu still have one sum here. So I'm still summing the second pair, and then I want to raise the mu alpha just because that's what I started to write here. Then I'm going to have a quarter. If I factor out this 2, then it leaves a quarter there. And it'll be, as I raised indices, mu alpha, and then I have f squared. So that, up to an overall normalization, is the energy momentum tensor for electromagnetism.
So what do we do in the second term then? How different from the first one? Yeah, right there, right?
Here? Right, that's the variation of this.
Oh, okay.
The variation
okay.
Of root
okay.
G is minus 1/2 times root G again times G mu nu times the variation of G.
Oh, okay.
Tim Weinberg. Like everything else.
I have a good derivation of one of those books.
Okay.
Okay, so, should we look at a component and see what, let's see what energy looks like.
Now we can set G to eta.
Yeah, okay, right. Choose coordinates again and go back where we started from. It can still be flat space. The whole thing can be done in flat space, right? You can change coordinates in flat space.
Right.
Spherical, whatever. So we vary the coordinates, you know, that turns into varying G. Get over here.
Yeah.
So let's look at the simplest components of this.
We're just pulling the whatchamacallit, the variation out then. Oh, wait, this is left over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Pull out a 2.
Oh.
Del
okay.
G.
Okay.
That gives me a quarter here too. Sorry. I probably
okay.
Two steps at once there.
So shouldn't we get a metric in both then, in both terms? No. Oh, we're not going to talk about that.
Well, there's
okay.
Del G in H.
Right.
And there's one metric, but this metric is this contraction.
Oh, okay. Yes, okay, all right. Got it.
Let's see what it is. Let's see 0, 0. That's going to be F 0 nu F 0 nu minus 1/4 eta 0, 0. F squared. What is F squared? What does F look like? Anybody remember?
It's some funky thingy with the E's and B's. I think you have E's on the top and on the bottom left, or side to the left. And
yeah.
Right.
Any idea which sign? It's anti-symmetric.
I have it somewhere. Good for you.
And then we have B3 minus B2, B1 minus B3, B2 minus B1. And if that's right, then if I put the indices down, the only thing that changes are the E. No, let's see, which way is it?
I have it backwards.
Yeah, that's right. What's that?
I have it backwards for the E's.
The other way?
Yeah, the
line. So we'll make this plus.
Yeah.
E's minus. Okay. So when I lower it, I multiply, right, the last three, right, I've got a 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. But I get two of them, one multiplied from each side. So I multiply these three columns by minus 1, and then I multiply these three rows by minus 1. The B's stay the same, and the E's flip. So then I get minus E down here, and I get plus E up there, and this is the same. So when I sum over all entries, it's just the dot product of this whole array with that whole array. It's the sum of corresponding terms squared. So I get minus twice vector E squared. And you'll see I have two copies of B in here, so I get twice B squared. So B squared minus B squared. That's Lorentz invariant. Okay, this thing is Lorentz invariant. So if E is bigger than B in magnitude in
this region. And you fly by at an arbitrary velocity close to the speed of light, E will still be bigger than D, because this thing can't change. Right? If it's positive in one frame of reference, it's positive in every frame of reference. If it's zero in one frame of reference, it's zero in every frame of reference. Well, it's zero for a photon, right, for light. The magnitude of E and B's fields are the same. So this vanishes for light. So everybody sees E and B the same magnitude for electromagnetic waves, no matter what their state of motion is. There's another invariant. If you take F alpha beta F mu nu, epsilon alpha beta mu nu, you can do that one. That turns out to be, I think there's a 4 E dot B. It's the dot product. So if they're perpendicular in one frame, they're perpendicular in every frame. These are the only two Lorentz invariant quantities you can build out of the Maxwell field. Just the Maxwell field. I mean, if you have other things around, then there's no. But, right. So we want to know what this thing is. T00, F0i, rho 0 column I, that's minus the electric field. And then I lower an index here. Lowering an index is going to change the sign, so I'll get the electric field. So my signs are probably completely reversed. Minus 1/4, and then we have this thing is minus twice E squared minus B squared. So we get, that's going to be plus 1/2 E squared, so I end up with minus 1/2 E squared minus 1/2 B squared. So my overall, I should probably have an overall minus sign on this. I get minus 1/2, guess what? E squared plus B squared. And what is that? Do you remember from E&M? That's the energy density of the electromagnetic field. Integrate over a 3 volume, you get the total energy of the field in that volume. That's just what T00 ought to give, right? The conserved Noether charge. So that'll be the conserved energy. We can find a conserved momentum, or, well, it ought to be a conserved momentum density. If we look at T0i, or let's do I0. I0, that's what you would integrate to get a momentum density. It's symmetric, it doesn't matter. But then what do we have? F I nu F0 nu minus 1/4 eta I0 F alpha beta F alpha beta. Well, that goes away. Why? Because eta I0 is 0, metric diagonal. So we just have what? I nu. If nu is 0, this term vanishes. F0, 0 is 0. So we only get Fij with F0j. Now, if I want to lower this index, I'm going to multiply by the metric. So that is. This will just be the electric field component J. Fij is this thing. Well, let's come up with a clever way of writing that thing. Fij is epsilon ijk times the magnetic field. It's positive. Because row 1, column, let's see, row 0, row 1, column 0, 1, 2 is B3.
So 1, 2, I get plus B3. And so on through this whole matrix. The alternating signs I've chosen here are exactly what gives this expression for F I J. So T I 0 is going to be epsilon I J K, components B K, components E is the same up or down. I can write this as B J, and that is
B cross B product
minus what is that?
Cross.
Yeah. B cross B. What is that called?
Pointing vector.
That's the pointing vector. Which is the energy flux, or the momentum flux of the field. So we're seeing the energy density and the momentum density, right? The integral of TI0 of V3x is the momentum of the field. The integral T00 is the energy of the field. So this all fits perfectly well with everything we know about electromagnetism. If you remember those, you know, this always occurs towards the end of some chapter, kind of in the middle. So no one digests it, but it's in that book. Go check your email book. So far, this has been classical field theory. Right? There's a lot to it. It's a big subject. But you now know the kinds of Lorentz and Wurm fields that we can think about quantizing. Most of them occur in nature, one sort or another, not Taylor fields so much, except the Higgs, maybe.
But
yeah.
Presumably, a lot of this stuff is classical, but it was thought of so deeply in the ways we've looked at it because of quantum field theory.
Yeah, people didn't do a whole lot of field theory until Maxwell. And there wasn't good language for talking about it until, you know, the besides Boltzmann notation, really. Well, I guess, well, Cayley Klein, you know, stuff. But, then the next field that people discovered was gravity, right? Well, Newton's theory of gravity wasn't usually presented as a field theory. You can look at Newtonian gravity as a field theory. It's a scalar field, right? You have a scalar potential. If you take a minus its gradient to get the force, you can write an action for that. So, you know, that, I guess that was done in the 19th century, but another was early 20th century, I think, right?
1920s.
Yeah. So this is newish stuff. And then Yang-Mills field was developed until the 50s. So this has been all in the last century that it's really taken a long time. But now it's very dramatic. Know what kinds of spins and masses and all of that. We've discovered a whole lot of particles that are described by these fields correctly. And have developed techniques to quantize them. I guess the only sort of classical field we haven't talked about is the Yang-Mills field. You've seen E&M as a gauge theory of U1. Last spring we did it. Last spring we looked at Yang-Mills field. And then we've been working through it. You did all of them, right? Okay. So, you've even seen them. Time to